Hello and welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out. Today I speak with Sahai Berhane Selassie, who's written a book about the old Ethiopian warrior class. We talk about 19th century to 1941 and about the Italian invasion of Ethiopia in the 1930s. Thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Sahai Berhane Selassie, author of Ethiopian Warriorhood, Defense, Land, and Society, 1800 to 1941. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for inviting me.
So first, tell me, how did you get into studying and writing on this subject?
Ooh, it's a long story. First of all, I grew up in a family that was full of these stories about warfare and warriorhood, because that's in the family background. Secondly, I was in Ethiopian studies, studying Ethiopian history and anthropology, and but that just took off from there. And there was a professor who was head of the Institute of Ethiopian Studies in Addis Ababa University, Richard Pankhurst. He asked me if I could do research on the Ethiopian warriors that fought against Italian invasion, 1935-41, and I was just in my waters for that. So that kept me going. And then I decided I should know the background, the sociological background to those people. That's what started me on this book.
Okay.
There is just something different. But this one, anthropology and history together, that's what started me.
Okay. So tell me, let's talk about the book. It spans, I guess, 141 years. How did you break it down? How do you lay out the subject matter?
Right, okay. First of all, it needed the historical background of what Ethiopia is. It also needed identifying what these warriors were. They were known as the Tawa. It was a group of warriors, a class of warriors, a category in society that constituted of farmers and everybody else. All those who considered themselves Ethiopians were supposed to be on standby all the time to defend the country against foreign invasion. So for that purpose, I needed to have the historical background and the sociological background. So in the first chapter also, you find that historical background. How did they come about? How did they become a category in the society? So that took me to digging up the history in from pre-Christian to post-Christian, 300 BC to 1800. And it's a very long history, so I put that in just chapter one. The rest of it then goes into the sociological background. If these were just farmers, how did they become warriors and on standby at that? What does it mean? So I discovered they needed to be training themselves all the time. Supported them to train themselves all the time. So for that, I needed to give the historical and sociological background what the training was about. How did they train? Training was just done by individuals who wanted to be in the soldiery. It meant, as they were growing up, parents would encourage boys to play war games. So you have a chapter on war games for children. And they needed to go hunting to become accomplished hunters, warriors. It meant they would go to the areas where there would be big game. In traditional Ethiopia, that was all the highlands, plus the associated lowlands. So they needed to go there. And it was a big deal. They needed to understand that it was important to understand this landscape, which meant they really had to go hunting. So that was part of the training, to know the landscape, to know what to do with warriorhood. They would be hunting, and they would be learning to aim, and they would be learning how to command and how to obey as soldiers, as warriors. So the training, not just thought, but also in hunting, trains them to be obedient as well as commanding, and really take responsibility. Thirdly, in the social background, there was something known as the fear of God. You know what that is, but for the that society, of course, is a very, very important concept. You have to be just, you have to be straight, you have to be straightforward and trustworthy. The fear of was the basic principle. They had to study those things as they were training to be just not just marksmen, but also real diligent, responsible, and fully aware of their environment, the physical environment, as well as what people do they come across as they go hunting. They should know them. And so these warriors spoke 3, 4, or 5 languages. Some, my father spoke 7 languages, if you like. He was one of the warriors. And so quite a range of languages they would speak, because they would be going through this meeting. And wherever they went, I discovered, the idea of warriorhood was so pervasive, they would be acceptable to the people. If they are not accepted, they'd have to make themselves acceptable by politesse. Afterward, after their training, they'll be back to their societies, their fathers, local warriors, and other patrons who reward them. So children have to aspire for that kind of reward, for that kind of training. So this was in the sociological background of the training. And then that was the first part of the book in general. Then in the middle of it, there is what happens when you become accomplished warriors. How does they get the hierarchy of warriorhood? There was hierarchy, starting from a bottom rank where they would be rewarded with swords and a small title. And then they can even become kings or kings of kings, depending on how much retinue they managed to attract. Part of being a warrior was to attract warriors to your fellowship, follow you. So that took them to the world. And then that's the part towards the final part of it. I deal with the, what is the politics of warriorhood? Was there any politics in warriorhood? That, yes. What is Ethiopia? How do you define Ethiopia? Are you responsible to define Ethiopia as a warrior? Yes, and each and every warrior was responsible for that.
So how, it seems, how centralized or decentralized was this? It seems, was there a lot of exchange of information on how to be a warrior across Ethiopia, or was it very regional or local?
As far as these warriors, which are a category of warriors, Ethiopia was a wide expanse of land. It can expand to whatever territory they come to hear about. There was big game to go into, to hunt. So that's the landscape. But the hierarchy of it would be starting from your own home base. You have to prove yourself as a warrior. Impress your local communities in your immediate family and then attract followers. And that will bring you to the attention of superior people with higher titles within the realm of the Nebuchadnezzar, the kings of kings of Ethiopia. And that way they would be attracting attention, they would join those hierarchies. So there was a strict structure that would take them to the highest level of the centralized monarchy ruled by the kings of kings. There would be several regional kings as well. So they can start from the bottom, join one of the kings, and then transfer themselves as they progress, acquire fame. They would be even promoted to higher echelons by their patrons. And it was important to attract the attention of these kings and so that they could promote you to the service of the kings of kings. So that was centralized more or less, but not the principle. The principles were personal, very personal. The kings of kings did not have to train you to be responsible or to be a warrior or to be this one now.
Now, what sort of weapons and armor and that sort of thing did they have, and how did they outfit themselves? Was it every person took care of their own, or did kings, say, grant, you know, weapons and armor to the people who followed them? How did that work out?
First of all, you have to look after your own weaponry. You can inherit it from your parents, or your parents can arm you with some swords and spears. In the traditional Ethiopia, or they were worthy enough when they came across some guns and things, they could buy them those as well. But initially, they would have to have their personal weapon of any sort. But the sword and the shield and the a spear were the must things. They would have driven them for themselves. Mm-hmm. And then, depending on how wealthy you become by farming initially, and then also by raiding, joining raiding parties, you can attract others, and they would come with their own weaponry, of course. And that's when you would have a large cache of, a large group of people following you with their own weapons, and therefore you end up having weaponry in your following, in your army, as it were, in your military setup. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the kings of kings would buy from traders, from foreign traders, mainly Arabs, Turks, and Egyptians, traditionally, who would bring them swords, which later, from the 16th century onwards, began, 13th century onwards, began to be produced locally. But earlier, just locally produced swords, spears. Later, flintlocks and other types of firearms were brought by Turkish and Arabic traders. Mm. They would buy, but only the wealthy, that's the kings and then kings of kings, would afford those. So they would have arsenals, but not in the modern sense of having military camps where the arsenals were kept. They would be deposited in the individual followers. Mm-hmm. That they were responsible for looking after those weapons. That was how the weapons were handled as far as the military leaders were concerned, yeah.
So how do you trace any of the conflicts they were involved in over that time period?
There were systems of calling up people to arms. There were chains of command. Anybody who wanted to lead for some reason, usually for foreign invasion, sets from the Sudanese side, the Red Sea side, or the Somali side, there were always conflicts coming from different people in the region. Like originally, the original enemies were supposed to be the Arabs across the Red Sea, because they stopped the Egyptians having their navy. That's the finish of the Egyptian navy around the 7th century. From then on, the Arabs themselves were engulfed by the power that was in the Turkish area. And those ones always threatened to invade along the Red Sea and on the way down to Tanzania and places. And so it was a constant struggle to be on the lookout for those coming to invade along the Red Sea coast. Asab, Massawa, Adulis, those kind of seaports were always threatened by either Arabs or Turks. And on the lookout, therefore, there were authority known as the Bahar Nagash, that is the king by the sea. Mm-hmm. That's the commander of the areas that were along the Red Sea coast. Mm-hmm. They would be issuing alarms whenever there was any threat. The alarms would be transmitted by runners to the king or the king of kings, and again by runners, the command would be given out. There is a huge invasion coming on, and from the point of those loyal to the king of kings would be mobilized that way. Once they were mobilized, the command from the local area to wherever the war front was supposed to be would be conducted by drumming, which has special sounds telling you to beacon, to slow down, to turn around, this, that, and the other, all sorts of chords to it. And they would be marching to the war front, as it were. So it was all horses. There were horses, but the horses were mostly for the commanders. The transmission of information and command was always on foot by runners through runners.
Now, did they have among them, in the more recent period, was there a national identity or a cultural identity, or was it more about working together against invaders? You know, what was the motivation on the national level?
Yeah, for this Chawa population, just these Chawa soldiery warriors, one of the principles was to defend Ethiopia. Ethiopia was a nation. As far as they were concerned, it's been a nation from about 500 BC. Mm. And they could be from any part of what you now see within the territorial Ethiopia. The borders have been fluctuating a lot. But within this territory that you now see, not beyond it really, at any time, it's never gone beyond that. Mm. This is the largest it has ever been. Minus Eritrea, of course. Eritrea was part of it. It's no longer what you see now as Ethiopia.
Mm.
In any case, the sense that each warrior was trained from childhood to defend Ethiopia against foreigners united anybody who wanted to be part of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They would expand to any border that has been threatened and settle there.
Mm-hmm.
They settle to our communities, warrior communities,
mm-hmm.
that would marry, stay there, sometimes for centuries, 3 centuries, 4 centuries, 5 centuries. They're still maintaining that identity of Chowa warriors. Mm-hmm. And that Chowa warrior identity was what would be defining the nation, Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
400, 500, 600 years later, the historians would say, we had set up such and such a community of warriors and such. If invasion had come in between and cut them off from the center, for instance, mm-hmm. they would reclaim it again. Like the best time that we in recent days that we have of this movement was the 19th century, reclaiming lost territories,
hmm.
was supposedly where these ancient troops had been settled in the past. So you'd go and reclaim those. That's been happening over and over and over again through the history, throughout the history, the two millennia anyway, at least 2,000 years.
Hmm.
But this is Africa, okay? And in Africa, I suppose also in Europe, population mobility was happening all the time. Sometimes people would migrate from the east to the west or from the north to the south or vice versa. And even through those migrations, the Chowa would seep through and claim to be part of the center, or they would be claimed to be a part of the center and reclaimed, as it were. So, the sense of nationhood was also sustained by that process, that historical consciousness of past settled communities of warriors.
Mm-hmm.
And the historical consciousness was also sustained because of the written literature in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Literature in the country recorded where this king had arrived, where that king had arrived, where this had been lost, where that had been recovered, etc. And that kept up the history also going. It was a very important matter to sustain the sense of Ethiopian identity. Whatever language you spoke, you would be assimilated, incorporated into the warriorhood as well. That is another element to it. You'd be incorporated into the warriorhood by being given titles and duties.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then you would be following the same tradition that they are training with children, with boys and so on. Into the warrior situation. Giving titles and therefore making them your followers was the third element of sustaining the Ethiopian identity.
Hmm. So how much do you discuss the Italian invasion? And you know, what do you go into as far as that incident or event?
I see the Italian invasion as part of a series of enemies that were defined by this warrior group as the enemy par excellence. First it was the Arabs, then it was the Egyptians, then it was the Turks, finally the Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
The Europeans became the defined enemies, Dina, as it was called in their terms.
Mm-hmm.
And Dina, because they started to hover around, to be seen around the Red Sea coast. Sure enough, they were Somalia, they were Djibouti, and then they were messing around Massawa to take, and they finally even took Eritrea.
Mm-hmm.
And so this transferring the term Dina, the enemy of Ethiopia, to the European, made everybody conscious that it was the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So That began around 1868-70 period. That consciousness about Europeans being the enemy now began around 68 when the British marched into Magdala. That's was the death of suicide of George II. And since then, they were very much vigilant. They were very much conscious of European arriving on the scene. Mm-hmm. So, chapters, the final two chapters of the book are on the Italian invasion. One that led to the Battle of Adwa, 1826. Mm-hmm. That's the Italian troops that marched from the Eritrean side, fought and were beaten back. And then 1935-41, 40 years on, Mussolini really, really wanted to revenge the Italian defeat of 1896. They invaded. To any excuse, really, from his, invaded from the Eritrean side and from the Somali, the so-called Italian Somaliland of the time, invaded from there, two sides. So there was the consciousness already, and I take on from that European attitude towards Africans and Ethiopians in particular, their need for taking more lands from the African continent, and the very, very conscious need of Ethiopians to always defend against this kind of invasion. So that's the basis for it, and I use the last two chapters to show us examples. I use examples from that. One of the things that was sent to highlight, asked me to highlight, is about warrior who was bringing women into the battlefield. And the Italian period is a very good example of that.
So, did was this group the primary military force for Ethiopia, or how did the central government, they had their own army and navy and that sort of thing? Is that's correct?
No, the Ethiopian government in 1935 did not have a navy. It didn't have even a proper sea board because the Italians were there. Djibouti was the main fort for Ethiopia at the time. But the thing is, and Ethiopia did not have a standing army until 1930. It was a school that was set up in 1930 only to train a standing army in the sense that we understand it in Europe. There was no standing army. Because these Chawa warriors were, the rest of the time they were farmers, they were probably merchants and civil servants. They become warriors whenever the leader rose. And that was still the case by 1930. Come 1935, there was a very, very, very few, not even 2,000 people who had been trained as a standing army, members of the standing army. Mm-hmm. They were very young, no weapons, they were very, very ill-armed, and they weren't even conscious of, they didn't even have salaries. They still have to bring their own rations, like the old Chawa warriors who have to bring their own rations. Mm-hmm. So when the Italians invaded, the Emperor Haile Selassie held back on the old tradition. Just beat the drum and summon up the warriors. So that's the defense was against the Italians organized. There was no standing army at all in Ethiopia.
So it seems like even though they had a very strong structure and military tradition, as far as when it comes to the industrial mechanized side, that they suffered for that.
They still suffered. Most of the soldiers that I spoke to when working on this Italian invasion period told me they didn't even have a clue what aeroplanes or motorized vehicles were. Mm-hmm. Like my father told me that they had to be shown where to shoot at the tires. The use of the tires from the cars were not even in their consciousness, let alone have them to them. But there were only two anti-aircraft guns in the country. These metal birds up in the sky were very difficult to comprehend. There's a very, very funny story. One student who had seen an aeroplane in Addis Ababa when he was a high school student found himself invited to explain this modern warfare. Can you tell us what this the cannon is? So he said, oh, they have this aeroplanes. They're very easy. They can't cope with the European landscape. The European landscape is so rugged, the planes will not do any harm at all. So people took him literally. And he later admits, I didn't know what I was talking about, he said. Mm. So right in the middle of the warfare, they tried to shoot our battery. It was killing them. What did you tell us? What is this? I'm going to kill you, said one of them. That he had to be... So he got very, very angry and went back to his home base because he had not been informed about this stupid thing that was pouring this liquid gas, poison gas, these bombs. And there were some people said, what has the earth done to them? Why has it hitting the ground like this? Of course, it was not just hitting it, but it was incendiary bombs. Going in all directions, killing them. As for this liquid that was raining, poison, they just didn't realize that was happening, that poison, they were being poisoned. They just started to be said, the Lord, of course, everybody was. So the consciousness about modern warfare was not there. Just let alone the weaponry. Most of them brought their spears, shields, swords, against this huge mechanized army invading the country.
Does this tradition still exist to any extent in Ethiopia?
There was a lot of attempts to get rid of the sense of being Ethiopian. The standing army was established after the war, and a lot of people just retreated to their farming, thinking it was just the usual. This emperor is organizing his bodyguard, let him do it, that's okay. But then come 1974, the government that came said, well, now we're going to take your weapons. And that was very offensive, because what are you, where is your manhood if you don't have your weapons, your shield, your guns? By then they had got to guns, they had been buying guns since the war as well. That challenged the people. Also, since 1930, really, hunting was prohibited. And the training of these people was very limited, very restricted. They tried up until 1935, until the Italian invasion, secretly to go and train their children in the hunting tradition. They did. A lot of them did train, which is what was useful later to fight guerrilla against the Italian invasion, 1935-41. But afterwards, hunting was prohibited. Training as well as soldiers in your own backyard was not encouraged. In fact, schooling, going to the modern schools was encouraged better than that. And there was a lot of talk about training the standing army. The involvement of the Ethiopian army in the Korean War, remember, after the war, there was a war in Korea, and the United Nations was there, so the Ethiopian troops also went there. That kind of popularized the standing army idea. So people were kind of discouraged from involving in warrior group. At the same time, however, even though they were not warriors, the sense of being Ethiopian was very, got some impetus from the fact that the Italians were driven out of Ethiopia in 1941. Ethiopia has won, it has survived again. So that promoted the notion of Ethiopian, being Ethiopian, identity of Ethiopian, of being Ethiopian. So it was sustained after a passion, but not in the sense of warrior. So that again was challenged by the Socialist Revolution of 1974, which started to go against the traditional feudal people. They were not feudal, but any warrior group, any warrior that was in the warrior tradition and had titles and things were seen to be feudal. That was, so that hostility was targeted. That, those who were already in that tradition in terms of warfare, in terms of Ethiopia. at the same time, as I said, there was this sense of being Ethiopian. The consciousness that the rest of Africa was also liberated, and there were countries that were, in a way, having to compete, what Ethiopia's having to compete with them for nation building, national achievements, and things like that. So all those things encouraged it. But the challenge against the feudal system did get rid of this business of I am in the case of my country. But I am an Ethiopian sense is still around. Mm-hmm. In spite of, again, in 1991, came a new government that said, we're going to set up exclusive ethnic territories.
Mm-hmm.
The ethnic business had been buried under this Ethiopian identity for millennia.
Mm-hmm.
And that became a very difficult matter. So there was, shall we go into that now? There is a big, big challenge against those who hold on to the Ethiopian identity, mm-hmm. exercising that identity into just one ethnic group, Amhara.
Yeah.
The Amhara are the ones who are sustaining the Ethiopian nationhood, which is wrong. What it did instead was those people who were living in this so-called ethnic exclusive territories of Amhara became targeted for all sorts of abuses and destruction.
Yeah.
Since 1991, that's been going on. But now what I'm noticing since over the last year is, again, the coming back of the Ethiopian identity for all groups concerned. There is still the competition from the exclusive ethnic territory, those who believe in that. But the Ethiopian spirit is still coming forward. There is up and down.
I see. So what resources did you use to research the book?
As I said, my growing up, my father, who knew my father, my parents, that was not a problem. I was an employee of the Institute of Ethiopian Studies at Addis Ababa University. Mm-hmm. So I was a salaried person. That didn't bother me. I loved doing the research on that one. So I didn't bother looking for research grants or anything. In fact, I didn't pay much attention for research grants. But that research of 6 years, intensive research on something I grew up with, mm-hmm. the collection documentation on that thing, and going around the whole country interviewing the resistance fighters gave me a lot of primary material.
Mm-hmm.
As the Jawa tradition had a lot of interaction with the lingua franca of the country, Amharic, which I speak, although I speak another language as well, but that was very useful. Mm-hmm. That's so references to written sources in Amharic, written sources in some Ge'ez tribe, in the Ge'ez tradition as well. So that's kind of, I didn't, having said that though, I must say, whenever I have been invited to be a fellow of this, Princeton, the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, I was a fellow there, the Social Science Research Council Fellowship in New York, this kind of places gave me the relaxed atmosphere to sit down and read up, write. Mm-hmm. Over the last 10, 12 years, I have been retired as well from teaching.
Okay.
So very dynamic. I really didn't go out of my way to look for financial resources, but the resources that I collected, documentation and oral traditions and things, and this relief fellowships were very useful. Mm-hmm. Those are very nice.
Were there any particular archives of written documents that were useful? Any locations that were especially good?
Oh yes, the Institute of Ethiopian Studies. That's the best library on Ethiopian Studies, including this traditional area. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The University, the Congress Library is another one. Of course, the British Library. Even Bodley Library in Oxford had a lot of resources for it. So.
Mm-hmm.
I used much from those as well.
Now, did you find many primary documents, that were centuries old, or was it more translations of the older documents, or transcriptions or copies?
through the 1975 to 41 period, I had access to diaries that the resistance fighters kept. I had histories written, manuscript histories written by them. So those are primary sources. And as I say, my father's autobiography itself, which was done with a lot of conversation with him. He did it, so that was good. I'm afraid I didn't go to Italy. I should have done to do the research. But as I said, I don't concentrate on getting this funding to go and research here and there. So I just did it whatever I found myself. Oxford, SOAS, School of Oriental Studies in London, DC, Library of Congress. Primary sources mainly from the Institute of Tibetan Studies and from the resistance fighters themselves.
Why did you cut it off? Why did you start it at 1800? Why not earlier? Or how did you choose that starting point?
Nothing in particular, really. To just concentrate and give the immediate background to the generations that have been, that fought at during the 1975-41 period. So it helped to highlight how there was something very important happened around that time. That is, the centralized government had faced a difficulty because regional principalities, kingdoms, dukedoms had become more powerful than the central government. In fact, the period is known as the era of princes. And 1800 falls right smack in the middle of the era of princes. And you could see what had happened, how it led to that position, and how it got out of, how people got out of that era of princes period. So that's the main attraction, was really that. Plus, the immediate backgrounds, grandfathers, fathers of those who fought against the Italian invasions.
What part of the research?
I to give earlier background in chapter one. I go to the ancient, fifth chapter goes from ancient times to Italy.
Okay. So what part of the research was most enjoyable for you?
Talking to the resistance fighters, listening to the in which they were really motivating themselves. There is some tradition known as Zera. They would shout at me, like they draw their sword, and thrust, they would say. And that's the way they spoke, the way they put across this structure of warriorhood, the way they really showed you what they meant by defending the country and the people and so on, that even the women, as I was speaking to them, I remember one very famous guerrilla warrior. She was spinning by hand, spinning cloth. And she was talking to me. So at one stage, she was telling me how she was the leader of a band of guerrilla fighters. And she needed to show me what she did. So she just did. She needed to put her spindle and cotton to the side like that and got up, you know, and said some fukara. We call it fukara. This, they shout at you and say what they want and how they are going to kill you, how they are going to defend the country, all that. That part of the thing, I really enjoyed it. I loved it.
Yeah.
Because it showed real power from inside, how it comes out, and how much they were enjoying it as well. I mean, you are aggressive, you're killing people and all that. How do you enjoy it? That was fascinating.
Right.
How can you enjoy it so much?
Yeah.
That part. I really enjoyed it, and it got me to understand how deep the sense of defense can go into individuals when they take it on themselves, when they take the responsibility on themselves. I really enjoyed that. Whereas I also spoke to those in the standing guard. It's my commander. It is what I'm told to do. I'm having to follow the command of His Majesty. There are nothing from deep inside that is coming up. Whereas in those ones, there was something very, very deep. not just the warrior, but also the sense of what they were defending.
Yeah.
So that part, that contrast, I really enjoyed it. I don't want to go back there.
It makes me think of, sort of Japanese samurai. It makes me think of European knights. It seems to fall into that whole tradition of, you know, the honorable warrior who will let you know what they want, what they'll do, and then they go and do it.
Yes, there is very much of that, except in your European medieval knights, there was something missing. The knights were group-oriented, I think. Or am I just thinking of the Knights of the Round Table? I don't know if I'm thinking just that, but there was a group feeling there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there's the gusto, the nobility, and all that is similar to the Ethiopian warriors, but the Ethiopian warriors were more to do with Ethiopia than just with their small group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The samurai also, there is a lot of similarity with the Japanese samurai.
Yeah.
Who would rather die than give up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, interesting. What did you find that was most surprising in your research?
What I find that was most surprising, the people took it for granted that it was their responsibility. And another thing that on reflecting back from my experiences of living in Europe and in North America, what is surprising was that those warriors were citizens of the world as well. If Ethiopia needs to expand, so be it. They have responsibility for everybody.
Huh. Interesting.
Yes, that was the most interesting aspect of it.
Yeah. So protect as many people. It was about keeping the community.
Especially if you can come into your structure, the
better. Yeah, interesting. What part of the research was most difficult to do?
Oh, yeah. When I started out to go out of the camp, out of the capital where I grew up and I was studying, to do research with those in the countryside, the resistance fighters in the countryside, what's the matter with your father? Why? Why is he sending you on your own? Or what's the matter with your university? Don't they have a man to send to us? Because women can't fight on the battlefield, okay, that's fine. But to go around talking to these great warriors, the men, that was a huge challenging thing. And I said, well, yeah, my father allows me to come and talk to you. And my father sent me with someone. He didn't let me go on my own. I had to have a shuttle and I had to have somebody going around with me.
Yeah.
It that made it a little bit difficult because in the southwest, he came across, the man who was coming around with me, came across people who knew my family, and that really spoiled my research for me. Oh, you are so-and-so's daughter? And then the stories I needed to be told was geared to that.
Yeah.
I did not mean, not this researcher from the university. That was a little bit difficult. As for one particular place, I have to say, I am descended from so and so. It was absolutely rubbish. Oh, you are so and so's descendant, grandchild. Well, of course we'll talk to you. You come in. That kind of local variations were there. Which needed a lot of fortifying my identity sometimes, and so on.
Yeah.
So that was the most difficult aspect of it. The easiest part of it was to invite them to Addis Ababa. Sometimes I might even pay for that, that's okay, but I have my salary, why not pay for that?
Mm-hmm.
And they would come, I would introduce them to my father, that's okay, they could just chat there and I can hear them chat and who can tell me nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I did all sorts of things to get access to this.
Okay. Was there anything you discovered that emotionally moved you, either positively or negatively, you know, made you sad or particularly happy?
Yes. In the story of the invasion period, the fact the one of the several, in fact, actually, warriors took their swords, climbed on the on top of the tanks, thinking they would get at the drivers there, or whoever was, how high they got, because they could see people in. They thought they could kill them there, and they thought they got shot. The other one was, any time the Italians took captives, like one time they caught a hold of this about 30 Pitavaris, equivalent to the English barons perhaps, were defending the south. The moment they moved in their pincers movement and caught them, the Italians. And they put up white flags and said, okay, we give up. Immediately they killed all of them. All the left one immediately on the spot. And among them were very aged people who had fought in Adwa and even before in Etemma and places in the rest of the country, and that's how they ended. That kind of place were very sad. Women as well. They would be fighting, they would be leading the wars, and sometimes, especially around 1939-40, many women guerrilla fighters were killed just before the liberation happened, or were taken captives and kept in prisons in the Red Sea coast. That kind of thing made me feel very sad for the warriors. They fought for it, and they didn't see the good results.
Did what you just described, the cruelty, did that in turn make any of the Ethiopian warriors more cruel and savage in return? Or, you know, how did that affect their attitude towards, you know, honorable warfare?
Towards the horrors of warfare?
Honor, like, did, you know, they had a certain sense of honor, I think, and then when they saw the Europeans doing this, how did they change?
It was more honorable. You know, they described themselves, the ones that I was speaking to, they said, we died. We died fighting for our country. And so, you didn't die, your colleagues died. No, we died. They died, and we, our hearts sank, we said, we died this way. We are the ones who died for our country. We died. So, the honor of dying for the country was emphasized by this, the atrocities committed by the invaders. Okay, death is what we ultimately paid for. It is just not just the ones that perished in the ground there, but also those of us, because we, our hearts were with them, they were our colleagues, they were our friends, friends in arms, we died. That was the end of us. And the emperor came back with his new modern ideas, standing armies, education, this, that. The rewards of the old type were not, didn't get the rewards that they had expected. Because the era is over. They suddenly found themselves caught in this era that was changing, in this new era. They didn't get the rewards they had expected.
So, what do you hope?
They kept themselves as a gift, the date on a die. That's fine.
What do you hope the book will do?
I hope it will transmit the idea that each and every individual is responsible for the defense of their country. Defense does not have to be just taking a gun and shooting people. Defense would have to be going along with whatever is primary, that is promoting education perhaps, growth, development, things like that. I hope it will transmit the notion that each and every individual has the responsibility for the country. Should take responsibility for their country. I hope that will do that. In addition to, of course, that was in the background, this is our history, and this is very important. It didn't come out of the blue. The sense of being Ethiopian, the sense of this strong tradition of, I'm Ethiopian, then it means this to me. It means this territory, it means these people. It did not come out of the blue. It has come out of this business of people dying for it. I want to answer it back. They died for it. This is what it means.
You mentioned some difficulties you had in completing the book, you know, the time it took and travels. Were there any other difficulties you had in finishing the book and getting it published? And if so, how did you overcome those?
I was writing in English. I shouldn't have done it. I should have written it in Amharic. Perhaps. Editing is what the time editing the language. My name. I'm not a native Finnish speaker. Although I speak the language, I write them in the language. It took, the editing it took 4 years or something. Back and forth with the publishers. That was, and I think that was one of the things. Also, I had a feeling that if I had stayed in Ethiopia, if I had not thrown out of the country and if I had stayed there, I would have finished it earlier. I was thrown out of the country in 1999. Not just me, I mean, 41 university professors were just dismissed. The university, so I was one of them. And then I had to leave because you turn around, you go here, you go there, people are following you. That was very uncomfortable. Not allowed back on the campus either, so working in that environment was not easy. We were not, there was, I also discovered there was a circular saying don't employ these people. So I left, went to America, went to the States. If I had stayed there, the book would have been finished quicker.
So when did you find, when were you able to come back, go back to Ethiopia and work comfortably?
First I left in the country in 1975, stayed until 89. I stayed in Britain. Then I went back to the country. And when the new government came in 1991, it didn't take them long before they dismissed us in 1992, 93. So they dismissed us and that was that. I have not been back since. Because I also received an email which from one Speaker of the House of Parliament after that. I've chased you to the ends of the earth. That is scary. Even by of the warrior tradition, that I didn't feel like going back to fight that.
Right.
So I
said,
I've been back since.
Okay. Do you have another writing project that you're working on, or is there anything else you'll be publishing in the future?
Oh, yes, definitely. I have two or three projects. One of them is the full history of the 1935-41 resistance period.
Ah.
That's what I'm working on now.
Okay.
I have others, but that's what I'm working on now.
Okay. Where can people find find the book and maybe your other writings? Do you have a social media presence or anything?
I'm trying to develop social media, LinkedIn and Facebook and a website. I'm not really up into this technology, but I'm hoping that I will have a website.
Okay. All right, that's all the questions I have. Do you have any final words or thoughts?
First of all, I really like your website. The military history, beautiful.
Thank you.
And you can understand why.
Yeah.
I love military history. Also, thank you for inviting me on that program. Also, I think if people see this, people hear me, and they have any information on if Ethiopians have any information on their family fighting against the Italians in 1935-41, I'd be very interested to hear from that.
Okay.
I'm going to draw attention to your website as well.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. Well, that's all I have. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you.
This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H, C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar. On YouTube under War Scholar 1945. And on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.